And good morning. Well, you're listening to Focus 580. My name is Les Schulte. I'm sitting in for David Inge this morning. And I promise I'll give out the right phone number. Usually they only let me on the air, Hank, when we're fundraising. So I think I gave out the fundraising phone number at the top of the hour. Oh, no. Yeah. Henry in the other room is going, oh, no. The right number to call if you have a question for Hank Spies, who's with us our first hour here on Focus, is 333-9455, or our 800 number is 800-222-9455. And our guest during the first hour is our good friend Hank Spies from Spies Home Inspections. Good morning, Hank.
Good morning.
And thanks for taking some time to come in and visit with us this morning. And
I always enjoy it. Answer
listeners' questions, and I see we've got phone calls on the line already. But first, briefly, it's summertime. And what are some of the things we should be thinking about our homes with the hot weather on us?
Well, certainly we want to get our air conditioning working as efficiently as possible. And one of the things that you can do to check that is to first hang a thermometer right in front of the return air register and see what temperature the air is going into the system. Then move it to the outlet closest to the air conditioner and check it again and see how much the temperature drops between the two.
Mm-hmm.
If it is dropping less than 8 degrees, you probably need a service call because the system is not working as well as it should. If we are dropping more than 12 degrees, we aren't getting enough air through the system. And this could be a partially blocked filter. It could be the fact that you have too many outlets closed so that we aren't getting enough air moving through the entire duct system. Or the blower has a multi-speed motor on it, and it is supposed to be wired so that when you shift from heating to cooling, it changes the speed on the motor as well. Most of the multi-speed motors have several speeds, and it may mean that the motor needs to be wired so it goes to a slightly higher speed to give us a little more airflow.
Mm-hmm.
But if we are getting more than 12 degrees drop through the system, we're not really working as efficiently as we should.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good suggestion. All of our phone lines are full, so if you want to slip your headphones on there, Hank, let's go to line one. Good morning. You're on the air with Hank Spies.
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
Sure.
Our son has bought, and his wife have bought, a 1940s, I would guess, era house. And they are taking paint off, so I have questions about how to protect them from lead poisoning, from the paint removal. And that age-old question, gutter guards. They've got a lot of trees around, and they're looking at different ways. And I didn't have much information to help them decide what would be the best thing to cover the top of the gutter.
Okay, well, if our engineer will take down a name and address, I will send them a sheet on the various options that are available.
Okay.
There are quite a number of them with greatly varying prices.
Yeah.
And some are so high priced, I don't think I would ever use them. Others are reasonably effective at much lower cost.
Have you seen these new foam inserts? That was one of the things they were looking at.
Yes, I have. They haven't been around long enough for me to know just how well they're working, to what extent you may get very fine particles accumulating in the bottom. That would be my only concern about them. Generally speaking, the leaves would dry up and blow off.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So there are several varieties of these things. I think I have samples of at least 6 or 8 on my desk.
Oh, my.
And that's just the beginning.
Yeah, everybody's inventing that new mousetrap.
Right.
Yes. Okay, now how about he and I have had lots of discussions about paint removal, and he certainly knows from my taking your advice in the days long ago of, you know, only priming over wood that you've just sanded off. But he's concerned about breathing lead dust and what sort of mask he should.
Okay, definitely he should be wearing a mask. And secondly, don't use a heat source to bubble the paint off, because you will then evaporate the lead and you can inhale it that way. So no torches or something like that if you've got lead-based paint. But any of the breathing masks, not the El Cheapo, the OSHA-approved breathing masks will take care of it. It's particularly bad for small children, pregnant women, things like this. They should never be in the vicinity when you are doing this.
Okay. So in the OSHA mask is what he thinks of as sort of that dorky-looking thing with the two kind of filters on either side so you look like you're ready for a sci-fi movie.
That's the general idea, yes.
Okay, all right. Very good.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Yeah, have a good day. Let's go to line four. All right, you're on the air with Hank Spies. Good morning.
About my compressor on the air conditioner, I'm just wondering what sort of current it draws. The plate lists horsepower at 1/10, and the voltage, of course, 210 to 230. How do I find out the amperage?
It should be on the plate.
Oh, it's got two numbers, one called RLA and the other LRA.
There should be an amperage draw on it. Generally speaking, we are drawing about 750 watts per horsepower.
Okay. 1/10 is 75 watts. Does it start up with a much larger surge than that?
Yes, it certainly does. And the 1/10 of the 75 watts is probably the fan, not the compressor.
Yeah. Can you just guess at some figure that it would...
Well, upon the age of the unit. You see, the power draw of air conditioners has been reduced by a factor of 2 by technological developments over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, if you are using air conditioning very much and your air conditioner is more than 10 years old, the only thing you can afford to do is throw it away.
Yeah. Okay, well. I still haven't found any amperage stamped on the plate.
I can't remember seeing a plate without it, but there should be something there. But generally speaking, you will figure that you are drawing probably 50. They say one horsepower is about 750 watts, 746, I think, to be exact. So we go from there, and you divide that by the voltage of 240. Mm-hmm. So we're running about 3 amps per horsepower for running, but start current is a lot higher than that.
Okay.
So you need, if you have a circuit breaker, that is sort of built into it. You need slow blow fuses if you're on fuses, okay. This type of thing.
Could you tell me what is an inverter? Plain people use it to make their own electricity.
Well, that converts direct current into alternating current. So that generally speaking, the generators are producing direct current, and all of your household appliances run on alternating current. So it is converting one to the other.
Well, we're told that the ones often used are no larger than an auto battery, and could they really run much important trade on that size?
As far as the inverter is concerned, yes, probably so. But getting it all depends on how you're going to generate it. Most of the auxiliary power sources don't generate all that much power, particularly photovoltaics and so on. You have to have a very large array. Wind power, yes, you may get some, but wind power is yet priced awfully high for the amount of power you get from it.
Okay.
Thanks. Sure, thanks for your call. Let's move on. Let's go to line three. Line number three, you're on the air with Hank Spies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a rather complex water problem that I've been working on for quite a while. I have about a 100-year-old house that's been added on to several times. So if I can kind of give you an idea where the problem is, the original house with the peak of the roof running east to the west and the one addition running north and south on the back of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So where I'm having trouble is about the middle of the north-south addition. And the guttering then makes an L. And on the middle of the north-south one, the gutters are overflowing. This happens after I've had them cleaned out. I had the larger gutters put in, and it's making a hole in the foundation in the basement, and water comes in. Not a huge amount, you know, it just trickles in, but the hole is getting bigger. So I have two questions. You know, I had larger gutters put in, and I don't know what else to do. I had really bad luck with gutter guards at a rental property that I own. They just got all clogged up, and then the water just spilled over.
Mm-hmm.
So, number one, what do I do to keep the gutter from overflowing? And number two, I watched some Fix-It show, and it talked about hydraulic cement, and would I use that to plug up that hole? And three, I know once I get the gutters to stop overflowing, I'll backfill and grade away from the foundation. But I'm sort of stymied as to what to do to keep the gutters from overflowing.
Well, usually they're a vertical piece that attaches to the gutter. So the problem being that the water is running down that valley so fast it's overshooting the gutter.
So well, it actually isn't happening from the valley. That's what's kind of odd.
It isn't happening at the bottom of the valley?
No, it's further over. It's the midsection of the north-south run.
Well, in that case, I would guess that the gutter wasn't hung level. In other words, we've got to have a slope on this gutter.
Right.
And if you have a low spot, then it's going to go over there. But
well, it should slant toward the downspout,
that's
right?
That's right. That's right. It should slant toward the downspout.
Okay. What I was thinking that maybe it was just getting from two roofs emptying, it was just getting too much water at once.
Well, that's possible. It depends on how many feet of gutter you have between downspouts.
Should I have a downspout at the valley?
If you've got some reasonable place to dump it, perhaps yes, but usually we don't have it at the valley. We'll have a splash guard there that keeps the water from overshooting the gutter, and then we take it off somewhere else. And we want to be sure that we take the water off in an area where we can put a downspout and extensions on it and drain it away from the foundation.
Right. I had an extension put on that downspout when I had those gutters replaced.
Yeah, but you have to look at how many square feet of roof are you draining through the downspout.
Okay.
So that it may...
So can you give me a formula on that about how much I should have? Or?
Well, not without seeing the house. But basically, it's a matter of getting enough downspout on. I've seen an awful lot of downspouts where we have an awful long length of gutter and only one downspout on it, and then, yes, it's going to go over. And let's face it, at the rain rates that we occasionally get in this area, there isn't a gutter system made that won't run over.
Okay, so then what do I do about... What about that hydraulic cement for plugging the hole?
You're plugging this from the inside?
Yeah.
Yes, that should work.
Okay. And then, so I can plug the hole. What about this thing that you're talking about, a gutter guard? That the place where it overflows, I would say, is about a foot long. Could I put a gutter guard there?
You could put a splash guard there where it goes over.
Okay.
Which is basically a vertical piece of metal 2 inches high or so that attaches to the outer edge of the gutter so the water doesn't go screeching over the top.
Okay, yeah, I think that's what I need there. Okay, now, if I go to somewhere like Lowe's and I say I want a gutter splash guard, they would know what I meant?
Probably not. They probably wouldn't be selling it because it's just basically a piece of sheet metal that's attached with a few rivets, and any of the gutter companies would be able to do it.
Okay. All right, and now talk a little bit about grading. Then do I need dirt there since...
Probably.
Yeah, since there must be some kind of channel that goes to where the hole is.
Yes, generally speaking, we want a... do you have plantings next to the foundation there?
No. Well, yeah, lilies of the valley and some vinca.
Yeah. As generally speaking, we like to have a layer of plastic or some such thing under them so the water doesn't soak down.
Oh, okay.
And otherwise, yes, you can add water. We, generally speaking, we want 6 inches of slope in the first 10 feet away from the foundation.
6 inches to 10 feet. Okay.
Okay.
That sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your call.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Before we go into the next call, a couple of callers called in, Hank, and said that RLA means rate loaded amperage. And that's what the one listener was trying should be looking for on that plate.
I don't think I've ever seen it marked in that way.
Mm-hmm. So maybe that helps him out. Let's go to line two. Good morning, line two. You're on the air.
Yeah, in the hallway between the ceiling and the wall, it's crack. You know, it's a crack along there, and it was suggested a solution. What they call cornering or some other. Is that correct or not?
Well, it depends on what the cause of the problem is, whether it is, how old is the house?
25 years to 30 years, I guess.
Has it always been there, the crack?
No.
And does it get bigger in the winter than it does in the summer?
Right. What's happened is it was fair size in the winter, and then in the summer now it's disappeared, actually.
Okay. This is what we call the truss rise phenomena. Actually, the ceiling is lifting off the wall.
Okay.
Primarily because in the wintertime, the bottom member of the truss is buried in insulation so that it is kept warmer and dries out more. And when it dries, it shortens. Well, if you take a triangular piece, such as a truss, and you shorten the bottom cord, the peak goes up. And we have all these cross members in there, and that lifts the ceiling off. There are several things you can do during construction, but once it's there, probably the best thing to do is to put in a molding that is attached only to the ceiling. It will hide the crack, and it will slide up and down on the wall a little bit, and you won't be aware of the crack. And from a an appearance standpoint, that's about the best we can do. Structurally, it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Is there any reason why it would be, I don't think, in the other parts of the house, mostly in the hallway for some reason?
It would be near the center of the house.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Well, that's an excellent idea and a simpler solution. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Glad to know it's only a small crack. The worst one I hit was one that went up 3 inches in the wintertime.
Oh, no. Oh, wow. The number to call is 333-9455. If you're outside of our area, call 800-222-9455 if you have a question for Hank Spies of Spies Home Inspection Service. And let's go to line number one. Good morning. You're on the air with Hank Spies.
Yes, relatively small question. I received a call from a tenant about air conditioner buttons sticking, and I guess I'm just looking for options, and my first thought was to use some WD-40. I wonder what your thoughts would be or what other options you might have.
Buttons on what?
Air conditioner. I'm sorry.
Window air conditioner?
Yes, a window air. In-wall air conditioner. I'm sorry.
In-wall air conditioner. Probably that may work. It shouldn't hurt anything. It very well may be that the cover is binding or something or other against the sides of the buttons that's keeping them from moving the way they should.
I see.
That's most often because when you work on it, you take the filter out and the front off and all this sort of thing. If it's not back in perfect position, it will bind against the buttons.
I was going to check that. It's a rather old air conditioner, but I was just, okay.
And, well, as I say, the old air conditioner, probably the best thing you can do with it is pitch it.
Yeah, you're right. This is an antique. As soon as it's working, I'm going to.
Well, it's one of those things.
You're why it's an antique.
you're basically, somebody is buying a new air conditioner every year and not getting it.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, sir.
Number to call, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. All of our lines are open right now, so if you have a question, we'll get you right in and get you on the air here with Hank Spies. Hank, any other money-saving tips that we should be aware of this time of the year as we try to keep our homes cool?
Well, one of the things is to take a look at the outside unit of your air conditioner and make sure that the thing is, airflow is free to go through it. this time of year when we have cottonwood fuzz flying around, it's amazing how much of that can accumulate, mm-hmm. and we need to get in there and wash things out, turn the power off, get a hose, wash out the coil, let it drip dry for 30 minutes before you turn the power back on, and go from there. Likewise, if, and this happens in a horrifying number of cases, the builder has put the clothes dryer outlet next to the air conditioner, check for lint accumulation.
That's a good tip, because that's what we were talking about earlier. That's exactly where mine is placed. I didn't even realize that that it would be a problem until you just mentioned it right now.
And secondly, the condenser cannot work well if you are blowing the hot air from the clothes dryer onto it. Matter of fact, your air conditioner may be running and doing almost no cooling at all in that situation. So that's a couple places to start.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sounds good. I see there are a couple of people on the phone right now, okay. So let's go back to the phone lines. Line number one. Line number one, you're on the air with Hank Spees.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question. Occasionally in one of our rooms, we get some shadowing from the framing.
Mm-hmm.
And just curious what causes that.
This is up near the ceiling?
Yeah, right.
Okay, that usually means that the insulation has moved out of place, and this is insulation shadowing. If the insulation isn't there in the wintertime, the surface gets colder than elsewhere in the room, and you may get a very thin film of condensation occurring there, and then the dirt sticks in it.
Okay.
And so generally speaking, this should be one of those things where you can wash the shadowing off.
Right, okay.
And, but it usually means that the insulation is out of place.
Okay.
This very often happens around the outside edge of the ceiling where right. the insulation has been blown back. Air
right.
blowing through the soffits has blown it back from the edges.
Right, okay. And that's exactly where it's coming from.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
All right.
All right, thanks for your call. Let's go to line number two. And line two, you're on the air with Hank Spees.
Thank you very much. Good
sure.
morning.
Good morning.
I have a question about dehumidifier.
Okay.
And it's in my basement.
Mm-hmm.
And when it runs, it's supposed to be quite an effective one. I used to have, there was someone living down there, and it was definitely needed then. And I'm not sure whether it is now that the house is closed up with air conditioning all summer, and no one living down there, no furniture, whether it's strictly necessary. And the other question is the way it functions. I don't know if you want to answer that first one.
Well, basically, the main thing that central air conditioning does is dehumidify. And very often we run a dehumidifier, and it reduces the amount of time that your air conditioner runs.
I see.
So it has that advantage. If we can keep the humidity down, we are more comfortable. So therefore, we don't set the thermostat quite as low. And so that dehumidifier can. How much water are you getting out of it?
I haven't used it this year.
Oh, okay.
And it drained into the sump, so I...
You wasn't aware of it.
I didn't know how much it... well, I suppose I did when it first was put in, because we put the drain in later. But it was definitely necessary in my house when there was someone living down there. But now there's no one... It would just make the air conditioning cost less.
It very well may.
I found it very expensive to run the dehumidifier.
Well, usually it's less than running in the air conditioner, but it all depends. I know my son has one in his lower level, and he said he can set the thermostat on the central air about 2 or 3 degrees higher and still be comfortable when the dehumidifier is running.
I see. I never tried that. The other thing is the way the dehumidifier operates. It has two options. You can run it so that it goes on and off automatically, or it goes on a 3-hour on and 3-hour off. And I found when it's on the automatic setting, it's cycling on and off continuously. Well, you know, not every in very short periods, and I thought that might be bad for the motor.
Well, I'm surprised it's cycling that much, because generally speaking, there is a humidistat in there that is turning it off and on.
Mm-hmm.
And if the humidity is high, it will turn it on. And it usually doesn't change that rapidly.
Yeah, I've had two of the same brand. One had to be replaced. And I found that the servicemen don't seem to know or understand much about dehumidifiers. It was from Sears.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right in thinking that if it cycles on and off very, very regular in short intervals, that it's bad for the motor?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes, you are right on that.
Right. So in order to keep the same one and use it, I should use the 3-hour on, 3-hour off?
Well, you may not need it. If you're using air conditioning regularly, you probably don't need it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Fine. Well, I just wondered about the general situation and general. Thanks very much.
All right. Okay. Thanks very much for your call. You're listening to Focus 580. The time is 10:33 on a Monday morning. My name is Les Schulte. I'm sitting in for David Inge this morning. Our guest is Hank Spies from Spies Home Inspection Service. If you have a question about your home repair, things that you might be thinking of doing to your home, maybe this summer going into the fall, and you'd like to ask and get an opinion from a professional, you can call Hank this morning at 333-9455. If you're outside of the area code, the 217 area code, call 800-222-9455. And let's go to line number one. You're on the air with Hank Spies. Good morning. Line number one?
Yes, sir. Yeah,
there you are. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
We are considering either aluminum or metal roof. Please give your opinion.
Aluminum for a roof?
Metal roof.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong with aluminum roofs. They've been around for 50 years, and you really don't have to do anything for maintenance on them. If they're properly installed, they will last at least 50 years.
Any local contractors?
Generally speaking, most aluminum roofs go on farm buildings, so most of the farm building contractors will do these, but any of the roofing companies can handle them. They can be continuous corrugated. They can be aluminum shingles, whatever. Almost any roofer should be able to handle it.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for your call. Again, the number is 333-9455. All of our lines are open right now, so if you have a question for Hank, we'll get you right in and get you on the air. Hank, that metal roof question, I think, was interesting. Are there many individual homes that choose materials like that for?
Not very many in this part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
I happen also to do a lot of work in Colorado, and yes, there are a lot of them out there.
Really? Is that right? Why is that?
Helps the snow slide off.
Oh, does it really? is that right? What are the advantages or disadvantages of a metal roof as opposed to asphalt shingles then?
Well, generally speaking, they're more durable. Asphalt shingles, the ones that we've traditionally used, are good for about 20 years. They now claim they have 30 and 40-year shingles. Generally speaking, I don't think they're lasting that long.
Mm-hmm.
It's an appearance factor as much as anything else.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. Well, I can see that, yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. You look at your average house from the street, and a good portion of what it looks like, it'll look like roof.
Mm-hmm.
And so it depends upon what it is you want. As I say, we use them a lot in heavy snow areas because the snow slides off more easily. We don't have any of these rough granules holding it in place,
mm-hmm.
or anything like that. And that can be a significant factor as far as weight load is concerned out there. We're talking about snow loads in this area, 10 or 15 pounds per square foot. Out there, they're talking 40 and 50.
Sure.
So it makes a big difference in getting the stuff to slide off.
Okay. 333-9455 if you have a question for Hank Spies from Spies Home Inspection Service. And let's go to line number one. Line one, you're on the air with Hank Spies. Good morning.
Morning. As long as you're on that subject, what would you have to do to change existing asphalt or asphalt shingle roof over to a metal roof?
Peel the shingles off and put on new roofing over it.
Okay, I was told that it condensed and I'd have all kinds of trouble underneath the metal.
Not necessarily, but you know, you take it off, you're going to lay down a layer of roofing felt under there. And that's all we've got under the asphalt shingles, too. So if we're going to get condensation in there, that means we've got moisture. And we're not supposed to be having moisture in the attic.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't get the condensation. One of the things that we run into continuously is we have a lot of crawl space houses in this area. And many cases, the ground surface in the crawl space is not covered with a sheet of plastic. This is absolutely essential to control the moisture evaporation. Even though you stick your head down there and it looks dry as dust, you'll be evaporating 2 to 3 gallons of water per day per 1,000 square feet. And you have to look at the house as sort of like a balloon. If we evaporate water in one place, it goes through the entire structure, and any place that is cold, it will condense. And in many cases, the coldest spot is the bottom of the roof. So that we lack of a proper ground cover in the crawl space can shorten the life of an asphalt shingle by 5 years.
Wow.
Well, I luckily took your advice when I built this house. I got all kinds of ventilation up there.
Okay. Then there shouldn't be a condensation problem.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks a lot for your call. Is it important then on in the crawl space to make sure that that plastic sheeting goes right up to the corners and
yes,
all that kind of stuff?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we like to see it lap up the foundation about 6 inches.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
So that if any moisture soaks through the foundation, it goes under the plastic and not on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you get it on top of the plastic, there's nothing it can do but evaporate up through the house.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to keep it underneath. Generally speaking, you don't have to tape the joints. You just lap them 6 or 8 inches. That will take care of the problem. But moisture from the crawl space, amazingly enough, can significantly reduce the life of the roof.
Interesting. We have a caller on line number 4, and let's go to line 4. You're on the air with Hank Spees. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is about converting from window units to central air. Is there a conversion between BTUs and tons that they use for central air?
Tons is about 22,000, about 12,000 BTUs.
Okay, thank you very much.
Basically, that number was derived for how much cooling you get from melting a ton of ice.
Really?
So that's where the term originated. But a ton is 12,000 BTUs per hour.
Interesting. Our number is 333-9455, or if you're outside of the 2177 area code, you can call toll-free 800-222-9455 if you have a question for Hank Spees of Spees Home Inspection Service. I think while we're on the subject of cooling our homes, when should we be thinking about maybe swapping out that old central air conditioner for a new one? If we're thinking it's maybe 10, 15 years old and it's working pretty good, should we be thinking about maybe upgrading to some of the newer models, or are we still okay with our 15-year-old central air?
Depends on how much you use it. If you don't use it very much, you're probably still okay. If you are air conditioning continuously in the past 10 years, we have developed more than doubled the efficiency of air conditioners. An air conditioner that's more than 10 years old produces about 6 BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity. Under the current regulations, the most inefficient one that can be manufactured for central air units produces 13 BTUs per watt. So, as I say, we've got a factor of a little more than 2 going in there. On my own house, I definitely, 2 years ago, threw the old one away, even though it was working.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do a lot of air conditioning and just couldn't afford to operate it anymore.
Interesting. Okay. It's 10:41. We have about 15 minutes or so left. If you have a question for Hank Spees, 333-9455, and people are on the phone, Hank. So let's go back to line number 1. Good morning. You're on the air with Hank Spees.
Thank you. I'd like to find someone locally who can do an energy audit. How would I go about that?
There are several things. Our firm does them, not in a great regularity, but generally speaking, you have to somebody who will take a look and probably do an infrared scan to determine insulation and this type of thing. As I say, we do them, and there are a number of people. The university ran a course for energy auditors here a few years back, and you might try the Building Research Council at the university and see if they have a list of local people who graduated from that school.
Great. Thank you
very
much.
Their number is 333-1801.
1801. Great.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's move on to line number two. Good morning, line two. You're on the air with Hank Spies.
Hi, good morning. We had a roof repair, new roof put on about 2 or 3 years ago. And after listening to your program during that length of time, I realized we made a mistake. There's no ridge vent in it, and there's only one exhaust fan. And I do have a moisture problem up there. So the question is, should I have fans put in to take care of that or a ridge vent? And which would be the more cost-effective to do that?
Probably a ridge vent is more cost-effective, but now you have to realize that a ridge vent has to be paired with ventilation in the overhangs. In other words, we generally speaking, warm air rises. So if we give it a way out at the ridge, we have to let air in. And
right.
That's usually done in perforations or slots or whatever in the bottoms of the overhangs. And
well,
likewise, we have to have so-called air chutes that keep the insulation from blocking the space between the bottom of the roof and the top of the wall so that the air can move through there. But basically, first of all, ridge vents don't make noise, and secondly, they don't have any operating cost.
Well, I'm aware of, I got that. I figured that from listening to you these past couple of years. If I have just three vents on one side of a ranch house under the eaves and one on the other side, is that enough?
You are supposed to have a net free area, which is the size of the opening. Of about 1/150th of the floor area of the attic. In other words, for every 150 square feet of attic, we should have a total of about a square foot of ventilation area.
Okay. Yeah. I need to do some math then. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call this morning. Let's go to line number three. Good morning, line three. You're on the air with Hank.
Good morning. Good morning, Hank. I'd like to read you three sentences from a Spies Home Inspection Service report and then ask you for an update.
Okay.
The report says, the siding was the best grade of stained horizontal cedar, possibly redwood. The stain was in good condition. An opaque oil satin such as this should have a life of about 7 years between coats.
Uh-huh.
Well, you're right on. You wrote that 7.5 years ago. It's time for us to do something. And here are questions. One coat or two, what happens if we want to do a change in color, or should we do? Can we do a change in color? Paint versus stain, and whatever happened to natural aging of cedar, and why was it stained in the first place?
Well, most people don't like the color that results from natural aging of cedar because it tends to go brownish black and so on, and as any wood does when it weathers. So they stained it to get a more uniform color from top to bottom and so on. One coat should do the job. It's old enough. It probably was an oil-based stain, and I would go back with an oil-based stain if it was. Generally speaking, you can use water-based stains over oil-based, but not oil-based over water. So that's the basic reason for it. It sounds as though it has done just about what we expected it to do, and I would imagine that a new and one coat of oil-based opaque stain would probably last you another 7 years or so.
Great. And the change in color?
It depends on what you're trying. What are you going to change it to? What color is it now? What do you want to change it to?
Well, it's kind of a bluish, and the painter has shown my wife lots of different colors, and she's considering them, possibly a lighter, more earth tone color.
I see no reason with that. As long as it's opaque enough to keep the existing color out, yes, you can change colors.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for your call. The lines are open if you'd like to get through. We have about 10 minutes left in the program that we can take some calls. The number to call is 333-9455 or outside the 217 area code 800-222-9455. If you have a question for Hank Spies from Spies Home Inspection Service. We did have a listener who called in, couldn't stay on the line, Hank, but they had a question they'd like to pass along. They bought some cedar outdoor furniture out at Menards, and they would like your recommendation on teak oil or a sealer. What should they do?
Well, an oil finish would be desirable. It certainly isn't teak, but I'm sure. But I would say probably that. But it all depends. If you like the color, that's as good as anything you can go to go with it, with a teak oil. So I wouldn't hesitate to do that.
Okay, sounds good. We have some calls on the line. Let's go to line number one. Line two. Okay, I'm sorry, line two. You're on the air with Hank Spies.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Spies, would you kindly advise me on whether if you have some damage on wooden siding and you decide that you want to have aluminum or other types of siding, do you have to repair the wood, or is it okay to just go ahead and side?
Just go right over it. They will usually put in a thin layer of foam, probably an eighth of an inch thick, so they have an even surface, but you can go right over it.
Oh, I see. So when it comes to reevaluating the house, do you people look under the siding to see what is underneath?
Yes, we do.
So what happens when you find something like that?
It's not a detriment at all. As a matter of fact, it's probably better than the new siding that was put on by most of the people now don't know how to flash it, and the old siding they probably did. So, and it's one more layer of protection. So it is not a negative factor.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. Line number one. Line one, you're on the air with Hank Spies.
Hello, Hank. We have a flower bed alongside of a curved sidewalk to our front door, and we want to have that flower bed raised, so we've added some dirt to it, but how can we assure that we won't have water running on the sidewalk and freezing? Is there a way we can dig something, a trench next to that curved sidewalk, or can we even lay something down that I don't imagine has to be as severe as the farmers would use for tiling water away?
Well, I'm trying to visualize what you're describing here.
The flower bed.
How much do you want? How much are you raising it?
Well, presently it's about 8 inches taller.
Okay, and what are you using between the sidewalk and the flower bed to hold the dirt in place?
We have nothing holding it. It's just dirt there.
Okay.
We're trying to raise flower beds higher for growing better drainage of the flowers, I wondered if we had to make a wall of some kind, or can we just have the natural slope? We thought we'd have annuals first and then the hedge of evergreen.
Well, if you have flowers with enough root system to hold the dirt in place.
Oh, okay.
That's the real joker, is the dirt going to wash on?
Yeah.
Not the water. I'm not as worried about the water going onto the sidewalk as the dirt washing onto the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm. And if we keep sloping that, working to get that up over that.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that the soil might be better and things grow earlier in the spring by being raised a little bit. And, well, thank you very much for your reassurance of that.
Okay.
All right. Thanks
and
a lot.
And what do you use, excuse me, if we wanted to raise flower beds other place, what would we, could we use to hold the dirt?
Well, they make some plastic sheets that go along there, and it will stand up and hold it reasonably well.
Plastic what?
They make a special plastic edging for this that would hold
and
it.
It could be 6-8 inches tall, you mean, or something?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And that would be at any garden spot?
Right.
Okay, thank
any
you.
Any of the big box stores, Home Depot, Menards, et cetera.
And does anyone, if one wanted to put wood there, how would one treat the wood?
Well, you would use a pressure-treated wood or else use redwood.
Oh, okay. And you could do that vertical?
Yes.
So that you could follow the curve.
Right.
If you wanted to. Okay. And with not eating anything out of there, we don't have to worry about pressure-treated and...
Well, pressure treated will keep it from rotting.
Okay.
It isn't a matter of the urea getting something out of there or keeping termites out or whatever. Basically, it's a matter of keeping the wood from rotting.
And I was thinking that if people had vegetables, they had to be careful what kind of...
not really.
Oh, okay.
Not really.
It doesn't get into the vegetables.
No,
used to say these railroad ties shouldn't be used with vegetables or something. Maybe there's nothing to that.
Well, I can't say I've ever had a problem with it. And the new pressure-treated wood has been, they've taken the arsenic out of it. So.
Okay. And that's what they were after.
Right.
Okay. And so old railroad ties might have that arsenic in it or something.
Probably not. Basically, that is a petroleum product. The only problem we've had with old railroad ties is the pressure treatment seldom gets to the middle, so you end up with a hollow railroad tie.
And are we doing anything to attract, what was the thing that digs into wood?
The termites.
Termites.
No, as long as it's pressure treated or redwood, no.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for your call. Let's go to line number 4. Good morning, line 4. You're on the air with Hank Spees.
Good morning. I've got a question about marine plywood. I've noticed when it rots out, you know, it rots out around the edges. And I'm getting ready to do an outdoor project. And I was wondering if there's anything I could put on the edges of it to keep it from rotting.
Anything that you can seal it with.
Yes.
Yes. You can go with any of the... spar varnishes or anything like that that will keep it from absorbing moisture from the edge.
So any varnish I can use, I guess?
Any exterior finish. You can paint it, you can varnish it, whatever, depending on what your final appearances want. But as long as it is designed for exterior use, it should work fine.
Okay, and then how many coats should should I just... put it as much as it can, you know.
As much as it'll absorb.
As much as it'll absorb. And that ought to hold it. That'll keep the, it'll rot uniformly, hopefully, then.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Okay.
We have a few minutes left. We could probably get another call or two quickly in if somebody would like to get in on the program. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We're spending a lot of time on our decks during the summer, of course. What should we be looking for as far as deck maintenance goes?
Well, there are quite a number of deck finishes on the market. Basically, we're looking for a water repellent. We don't necessarily want waterproof because we don't want something that forms a film on it. Basically, we want a water repellent or an oil finish of some kind. But try not to paint them.
No paint?
No paint.
No paint, okay. And is that something that should be done every year as far as...
It depends on what you use. Every year or two, probably you're going to. Decks are very hard to maintain.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of a personal question. I always go out and look at my deck and go, oh, man, I'm going to have to do something here sometime soon. What about the synthetic woods, if that's the right term to use?
They do very well.
Mm-hmm.
They do very well.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps they're a little bit more expensive, mm-hmm. but the color is molded in. They don't absorb moisture, so that the synthetic decks have gotten very popular.
Mm-hmm.
We've also had a number of tropical hardwoods, such as ipé and things like that, that have done very well. But again, they don't seem to be very common in this area.
Mm-hmm. And quickly, if someone has a sun porch or one of their, like a three-season room,
mm-hmm.
What should someone be looking for with that type of room as far as maintenance and upkeep this time of the year?
Basically, to keep it from leaking.
Mm-hmm.
That's about all you can do with that type of room.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you'll want to set undoubtedly screens and probably storm windows, glass that you can close it off, and that should handle it.
Okay, sounds good. Hank, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Another fast hour again on Focus 580. Our guest this first hour has been Hank Spies with the Spies Home Inspection Service.